This is John Van Eenwick, Psychological Development, February 4th, 1995, tape 1 of 3.
Okay, for those of you who were not here last night, and for those of you who were and still would like some sort of a review, we talked about individuation as a kind of dual process. One of the processes is a constantly repeating, always active, always doing the same thing type cyclical dynamic. And we called that the synchronic aspect or dynamics of individuation. And then there is that which evolves over time as a result of the feedback loops that are created by synchronic dynamics of individuation. The feedback loops between perception and experience, for example, the feedback loops between archetype and image. And one thing we did not get into last night that I'll just sort of briefly mention right now is that all archetypal images have a propensity to represent that archetype. So there is a kind of conjunction between patterns. The pattern inherent in a content or an image in our environment, and the pattern that is contained in the archetypal form within the psyche. And when those two patterns come into conjunction, the archetype and the image combine to create a symbol. And it is through symbols that the diachronic dimension of individuation gets going. That's how we progress in terms of the refinement, the sophistication, the development of our own inner personality. It happens through symbols. And this is why, if you're a Jungian, the environment constantly talks to you. It constantly has information for you, and particularly those people closest to you. And the most creative, fruitful information that can come from the environment, whether it be people or objects, are those messages that create conflict for you, those that really make life difficult, those that really make you want to get out of the situation you're in. Those are the ones you want to begin to really listen to very carefully. And that's why being a Jungian and being interested in individuation is such a pain in the ass, you know, because every time you really understand that it is to your advantage to get out of a situation, if you're faithful to the process, then obviously you know you have to stay in it. Could we part the circle a bit and we'll just slowly amalgamate here as we go further? So basically, to put what everybody had to suffer through for about an hour and a half last night into about 5 minutes, the synchronic dynamics of individuation consist of constantly repeating cycles that derive from tensions of opposites within the psyche. Tensions of opposites within the psyche exist because the psyche is a phenomenon of energy, and energy always flows between poles. Areas of greater energy always flow to areas of lesser energy. Consequently, in the psyche, whatever becomes overemphasized or has too much psychic energy invested in it will tend to lose that energy, and that energy will move in the direction of areas of the psyche that are underemphasized. That in this particular category of behavior or perception, those aspects of the psyche that are not participating at their fullest will receive greater energy from the archetypes. And the way the archetypes direct energy into those areas of the psyche is, as I just said, by creating symbols. By getting our energy invested in something out there. Pardon me? Yeah. Probably the biggest example is in romance, romantic relationships. That's where we really get hit all the time with symbols. And those of us who have been involved in what's called sequential adultery, you know, where we're just going from one person to the other, that's when we are seeing individuals in the environment as symbols of what we need to connect with in ourselves. So that, for example, I fall in love with this woman over here, and she's everything to me, and I know that my life depends on having a relationship with this woman. And so I court her, and she acquiesces to my overtures, and we start having a relationship, and everything is fine until 6 months later, when actually I'm really kind of more interested in that woman over there. And that woman over there now really represents all that this woman over here could not be for me. And represents the absolute breadth and depth of my soul with which I have to connect. And I know that she is the one who can facilitate this for me and do it for me. And so I, pardon me?
A form of projection.
You bet. You bet. And it's a projection of the soul image. Right. And of course, I'm sure every one of us here has been through that wonderful part of life where the soul image suddenly falls off the person onto whom it was projected. You know? So that the person who was everything to us and absolutely represented the breadth and depth of our lives suddenly is relatively pedestrian and just like all the others. You know, that's a wonderful stage in relationship. Could we do another circle enlargement here for just a sec? If we end up totally with the experience we have where the symbol is always trying to get us to connect with the parts of ourselves that are underemphasized. And particularly in a culture where gender roles are relatively opposite one another, which in most cultures they are. In fact, this culture probably has some of the least differences in gender roles of any culture in the world. But in a lot of cultures where the gender roles are particularly stereotypical and overdrawn in opposition to one another, clearly women will be attracted to men and men will be attracted to women as ways of getting in touch with those dimensions of their personality that are not being lived out. And what happens is, at some point, we have to understand that it's not simply the connectedness with that person that we need, but it's the connectedness with what that person represents to us that is a part of us that we need. So the quarterback of the football team who's rough and tough, who falls in love with the most adorable, cute, little, cuddly, squirrel-like cheerleader on the cheerleading team, it's pretty clear what he needs to get in touch with there. And frequently that will be reciprocated, and it's very clear what she needs to get in touch with. And eventually they will become dissatisfied with the ways in which each of them embody that aspect. And that's the key at which the projections need to be withdrawn. And they need to understand that, of course, that person is inadequate because it's not something we live out through somebody else, but it's something we get an understanding of how to live out in ourselves by observing the other person, that sort of thing. And what happens in long-term relationships, which really kills long-term relationships, is that we divide these things up and our relationships become neurotic. So that what happens is, I no longer do the checkbook because I'm really lousy at it. And you no longer take care of the car because you don't know what's under the hood. And eventually we start doing for one another what the other needs to develop in themselves. And this is where we get into type and function, by the way. You asked the question about typology and individuation. What happens is we grow as certain types and functions. And then when we have those relatively well mastered, the psyche will give us a call to go into the other type and function. For example, I've said I'm an extroverted intuitive, which I am. I've always been an extroverted intuitive. Well, when I wrote my doctoral dissertation, all the brilliant ideas in the world were not going to get me my degree until I sat down and meticulously worked through one of them, which was a real introverted sensate type experience. And I almost went nuts. I mean, I almost went out of my mind. Abused my kids, you know, all the things that we do to keep ourselves alive during such times. Really was just a very obnoxious person, but slowly began to get kind of sucked in to the beauty of the nuance of language and the beauty of finding the absolute right word, not only in terms of what it says, but in terms of its rhythm in the meter of the sentence. And writing became for me this. Well, I write all the time now. You know, I can't be anywhere without my little notebook computer, you know, so I can write because it's almost like a drug at this point. That introverted sensate is so important to me, you know. So that's where the psychic energy begins to flow into the opposite of what we are. And there's an initial resistance on our part always to that because we don't do it well. You know, the problem for me when I was first writing my dissertation, although you know I had been writing all my life, you know, when in high school we had to write haikus, you know, we had to write paragraphs, we had to write essays, and I'd been doing it all my life, but the dissertation was where I really had to get serious about it. And it was something that was a formidable challenge, and I resisted it, and I didn't want to do it, and I thought of dropping out. And I came to some positions in life where I could easily have dropped out of the doctoral program, except for my wife. You know, that because, to make a long story short, she wanted to go to a particular place. I wanted to go to a particular place. There was nothing for her in my place. There was nothing for me in her place, so we compromised and moved back to Chicago, where it was very obvious that about the only thing that I was really going to be able to do there was write my doctoral dissertation. You know, so you know, we hated each other for 3 years because both of us at that point were involved in dynamics that were taking each of us into where we really needed to go, but we both were resisting. It was really a very interesting time in our lives. So that's how that works. So that's kind of the synchronic stuff. Jung says that only where a symbol offers a steeper gradient than nature is it possible to canalize libido into other forms. And what he's talking about there is we have these instinctual drives, and the instinctual drives basically just kind of keep working themselves out. But then, as part of those instinctual drives to feed ourselves, to shelter ourselves, to procreate, repeat ourselves, that sort of thing, along with those instinctual drives is an instinctual drive to come to consciousness. And the process of coming to consciousness is instinctual because it is in the service of the survival of the organism. Any of you who have studied Alfred Adler will be familiar with this. Adler talks about how poorly adapted we as humans really are to survive in the world. We don't have any claws. We don't have any fur. We're really not very quick, and we're not very strong. So in terms of our ability to cope and adapt, we don't do very well. But what Adler said we do have is the ability to form groups, to combine our efforts, to work cooperatively together in ways that then give us one up over the other species that do not do that sort of thing. Okay? And of course, if you look at all the species in the world, we could systematically eliminate just about every one of them. And in fact, that's precisely what we're doing. And the only real species that we don't have much luck with, of course, are the insects. And if you look at the insects, that's precisely what they do too. They get together in groups, and they work in groups together and accomplish these incredible things. And it's you know, an open question now as to which one of these species, the human or the insect, are going to survive the other. And of course, if you're a betting man, your money's on the insects. You know, clearly, that they're the ones who are going to make it. The cockroaches can survive nuclear holocaust, you know, so there you are. This sort of a thing. So the idea then is that consciousness and the ability to work together is an adaptive capacity. It's an adaptive skill, and we need to learn how to be conscious. And now we're going to get into the diachronic aspect of individuation, which is how we go about doing that and what the process is according to Jung. Now, at any point, feel free to raise your hands and, you know, ask for something more, something different. Put in your own knowledge about the subject, that sort of thing, because I'm the type of person who will just go on and on and on and on and on, you know. Yeah. Yes, it says, well, let me give you a couple of quotes. Jung says that the psychological mechanism that transforms energy is the symbol. Okay. That's the psychological mechanism that transforms energy. That's volume 7, paragraph 88. So symbols are energy transformers. Symbols, really, if any of you are mathematically inclined, are algorithms. You know, they basically show the psychic machine how to do what it needs to do. So the psychological mechanism that transforms energy is the symbol. And correspondingly, three paragraphs later in paragraph 91, he says, only when a symbol offers a steeper gradient than nature is it possible to canalize libido into other forms. Jung felt that this was symbolized by a tribe that he once visited that had a ritual every spring where the men would dig a large hole in the ground, and they would dance around the hole with their spears. And at a certain prearranged point in the chant that they were chanting, they would take their spears and put them into the hole. And he asked for the words of the chant, and they were translated as basically, this is not a hole, this is a vagina. And he thought to himself, oh, well, okay, this is a fertility rite that creates a symbol that takes psychic energy from the sexual libidinal type behavior and attracts it toward agriculture. Because agriculture is very analogous to sex. You know, it's the exact same thing. You know, you open up the earth, you put the seed in, you wait for the seed to grow. Okay, well, that's not too hard to understand. So that the symbols that surrounded agriculture were highly sexually charged. And they were highly sexually charged because they were taking all that sexual libido and directing it away from sexual behavior into agricultural behavior. Parenthetically, if you look at, for those of you who are interested in the Judeo-Christian tradition, if you look at the Old Testament, you realize a couple things right away. First of all, it's the written tradition. It's not the oral tradition. So, for example, we're taping this today, but were we not taping this, this would be firmly part of the oral tradition, which is a tradition that I cherish. When I preach, I never write the sermon out, ever. Because the oral tradition is very fragile, it's very delicate, and if it is not repeated by other people, it dies. So that if it's not compelling enough to be repeated by other people, it's dead as soon as it's spoken. So there's something about the oral tradition that is very alive, and it's very organic. It's constantly changing. It's constantly considering. Whereas what's written is that which is encoded and meant to be passed down for people to memorize, so to speak. Well, the whole Old Testament is that. You know, it's all written stuff. And the oral tradition is just lost. And it happens to be written by a very small group of Hebrews who really were actually Egyptians. They had been living in Egypt for 400 years, and they were assimilated. They were pretty much Egyptians. And these people suddenly found themselves moving out of Egypt into an area they had no understanding of whatsoever, under the direction of some very powerful religious leaders, who, when they finally got out of Egypt, found themselves immersed in not only a whole area of fertility cults, which were using all of these sexual symbols for agriculture that we're just talking about, but they found themselves among all of those Hebrews who were their fellow family members who had not gone into Egypt and who had not experienced this incredible conversion and who were practicing the same religion but in a very pagan sort of way. And as all people who are recently converted, they absolutely reacted furiously against this. And so when you go through the Old Testament, particularly that stuff that's the Torah and Joshua and Judges and Kings and Chronicles, basically anything up to the prophets, you're getting an account of people who are absolutely out of their element, fighting for their survival in a world of symbols that they don't understand. And they don't understand the symbols as symbols. They think that they're literal. So you take all of these people who don't have these symbols, and they've come into this area where it's all symbols, and there's all this agricultural metaphor going on of fertilizing the great Mother Earth type thing, and they're so literal-minded because they're not familiar with the whole tradition that that's exactly what they start doing. They start having intercourse with everybody around, and venereal disease starts going up, and there are all kinds of plagues. And of course, then everybody knows, oh well, you know, we've got to put some restraints on this. So all that stuff that's very anti-sexual in the Old Testament comes right out of that inability to understand the symbol by a group of people whose religion is so new to them that they've got to hold on to it by their fingernails. It's a fascinating sort of thing when you begin to realize that. So the symbols that then direct people's energies into pursuits other than the instinctual are the ones that are in the service of developing a more highly articulated consciousness. Now, this is the way this all happens early in life. Obviously, early in life, consciousness is relatively absent from the picture. I mean, we're not conscious when we're babies. When we're infants, we might be aware, but we certainly have no ability to reflect. We have no ability to consider. We can't really process things cognitively. So we tend to process them emotionally. The experience of our lives, the experiences of our lives tend to come to us in the form of what Jung called feeling tones. If I am hungry and there's no food, I experience a discomfort that is powerful enough that my awareness of that discomfort is activated. If I am hungry and I always get food the minute I realize I'm hungry, so that I never have to develop the feeling of what it's like to be hungry and unfed, I will not develop any consciousness. I will not have to reflect on that situation. I won't have to learn anything about that because everything is just coming and I'm fine and the instincts are gratified and that's it. So the first thing that helps to raise consciousness is frustration. The second thing that helps to raise consciousness is the archetypal valencing of objects in the environment. And we know that one of the ways infants learn about their environments early on is through their mouths. You know, they pick it up and they put it in their mouths. That's how they learn about it. Everything, dirt, the family cat, you know, their own toes, you know, their brothers and sisters' toes. You know, this is how they explore their environment with their mouths, because the mouth is an organ that is already functioning in an instinctual way in accordance with the archetypal images. So the archetypal image originally says to the infant, basically this, you're hungry, you want to eat, suck that. So the infant does. So the mouth as an organ is archetypally sensitive. And as life then goes on, that organ can be used to explore the environment, which then leads to a number of things. A, increased awareness, and B, increased frustration. As I said last night, when we as parents come and frantically remove from the mouth of the infant that thing that we are afraid is going to be hazardous to their health, and often is. You know, if you want to explore the family cactus with your mouth, it's going to be a very unpleasant experience. If you want to explore the bottle of ammonia under the sink with your mouth, it could be life-threatening. So then there's a certain amount of frustration with that, and the child, as their own motor coordination begins to develop, learns to explore the environment in other ways. Yes?
I know you're talking about more normal development, but I wonder if you could reverse just a little bit and speak to what happens to a child whose frustration is abnormal. And
yeah.
Then don't trust that archetypally.
Right, right. The question is, what do you do when the child's development is not, let's put it this way, when a child is born into an environment that is not normal, whatever that word means, but it, at any rate, does not really contribute to the child's best chances for development. What happens then? We'll get into that. We'll get into it right now. What happens to the child as the child is growing up in an environment is that the archetypal valencing of images in the environment creates a situation in which categories of experiences become associated, if you will, or connected to, or suffused by, permeated by, the same feeling tone. So the feeling tone of frustration will become connected to a whole category of experiences. And as the experiences and the feeling tones combine in the child's mind, so to speak, the child develops a whole raft of different feeling tones connected to different experiences, those experiences of which activate the feeling tone when the child is next in that experience. And that's a very convoluted way of saying once bitten, twice shy. The child who has a negative feeling tone experience with some aspect of the environment, when seeing that aspect of the environment again, will have the same feeling tone, And this is one of the ways in which we learn to avoid that which is dangerous and to connect with that which is life-promoting. Now, Jung said that anytime you get an archetypal nuclear element, as he called it, that is surrounded by a network of associations from experience, those complexes, which he called them, will influence our perception and behavior. Those complexes become metabolizing devices for life. As we go through life and have different experiences, the complexes will assimilate those experiences more quickly than consciousness for two reasons. First, they predate consciousness. Before we are consciously aware of what's going on in our lives, before we have the capacity to reflect and make any kinds of decisions about what we want to do, the complexes are already metabolizing our life experience. So the ego, whatever that is, but I think we can agree that it's our functioning capacity that depends on things like rationality, comparison and contrast, definition, thought, reflection, cognition, that our egos, when they finally begin to come into shape, the complexes have been doing what they do for 6, 7, 8 years. And they compete with the ego for the data that comes in from the environment. And here's an example of that, a very positive example. First I'll give you just a regular example, then I'll give you a positive example. So first of all, the complexes predate consciousness. And secondly, feelings are able to process data with lightning speed, whereas cognition takes a long time. Please.
Feelings processing.
Pardon me?
You're saying feelings processing.
Yes.
You'll have to explain.
I will. That'll be my second example. Well, that'll be in both of these examples. Okay.
How feelings can.
Yeah, right. The first example is going to be an example of the way in which a complex will compete with consciousness for the data from the environment. Okay? Let's suppose I'm a war veteran. And let's suppose I've been in combat, and I know what it's like to hear guns, bombs, loud explosions, that sort of a thing. And it's 20 years since I've been in combat. I'm walking down the street here in Seattle, and a car backfires. And I immediately go into a defensive stance that's left over from my days in combat. I immediately, in a very split second, remember everything I ever learned in combat about loud noises, and I realize my life is in danger, and I begin to take protective steps. Right behind that emotional response is my conscious awareness, which says, whoa, this is Seattle. Nobody else is ducking for cover. There's a car down the street with a blue cloud behind it. This is an automobile backfire, you see. And at that point, my consciousness is taking an aspect of my experience and competing with the complex that's left over from my battle experience, competes with that complex for the information, and in that case, actually peels the information off the complex and assimilates it to the ego. And I say to myself, yeah, okay, it's all right. That's an automobile backfire. I'm all right, and I continue on my way and, you know, go about my business. That's an example of complex and ego. Yeah?
You said the consciousness, not the ego, processes that information is different from the complexes.
Yeah. And I'm kind of using ego and consciousness in a very irresponsible way here. Let's draw a ground rule here, and in a classic Jungian sense of the word, say that the ego is the experiencing subject of consciousness. Consciousness is like a feeling tone. The ego is a complex, like all the other complexes. But rather than its associations being organized by a feeling tone, the ego's associations are organized by consciousness. And of course, that's a very facile way of describing things because we still haven't defined either ego or consciousness. But you know, but we all know what we mean, right? You know, it won't be on the exam. Don't worry. But it's basically whatever those things are that lead us to be able to process things cognitively. We call that consciousness, you know, reflection. And the ego is the thing that is experiencing that process. And is doing well. There's an interaction there. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. You have a question?
Is it all right to think of that in terms of a just what your example? You know, working through your example, my own experience is I find it as a filter that happens after. I mean, nothing really changes the initial contact with that complex. I mean, once it's formed and the feeling tones are the same and everything, it's just there's a filter after that
right.
allows the response to modify.
Right. Absolutely.
And
sure.
You may experience that. That's an add-on
process. Right.
Without that learning experience, you wouldn't have.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yep.
What's wrong when a person can't process the information and stays in the relived experience? What went wrong?
Two things. I'm thinking in twos today, so don't. Whenever I say two things, don't believe that. That's just the way. Then the complexes become the primary assimilating devices of the psyche. And they become, it's a competitive type thing. And we know, for example, that children who are not given cognitive challenges early in life do not develop the brain synapses to process those kinds of cognitive challenges. That if the environment is not sufficiently enriched, the person's brain does not develop. Physiologically, in terms of actual synapses. Yeah. So you talk about impoverished environments and why should we care? Well, it's a lifelong event. And you don't want to raise a whole population of people who can't process cognitively because it's dangerous. Because the one thing about feelings is they are absolutely lightning fast, but they're not always real good at drawing distinctions, as in the auto backfire. Another way of emotions processing things, and I'll get back to this, what happens. The one thing that's very helpful is if I step off the curb, and this happens to me more and more the older I get, I'm thinking about something else, and I'm basically a jaywalker anyway, you know, coming out of Chicago. And I'll step off the curb, and if I hear an automobile horn, my emotions will get me back on the curb much more rapidly than my ego consciousness will. See? So that I'll be back real fast. And one of the reasons that emotions are able to process so rapidly is that they don't rely on reflection. There's no reflection in emotions. They're just instantaneously, whereas consciousness always reflects. As I said last night with Robert Nozick, true rationality is always dissatisfied with itself. So if you're really thinking, you're also thinking about the way you're thinking. And that takes time.
Feelings are also in the part of the brain that is more primal.
That's right, right. Limbic. Yeah, absolutely. It's closer to the medulla. Yeah, right. Yeah, that's right. That's right. The neural pathways are not as complex, and they don't have to go as far, that kind of stuff. Yeah, absolutely. The other thing that happens with regard to what goes wrong is that a complex proves to be far more adept at dealing with the life experience the child is in, and this is where you're talking about, where we're talking about the disordered environment. The complex is far more competent to deal with what's going on in the child's life than is consciousness. I would say that probably 50% of the people I work with in analysis have been through a life experience very, very early in life where they had a choice. They didn't know they had a choice, but they had a choice. The choice was either to come to consciousness and kill themselves or stay unconscious and survive. And when they come into analysis, that's still going on. See? If you are born into an environment that is horrific, becoming conscious of it is not necessarily going to improve your chances for survival. So you stay unconscious, and you operate in the complex. And the problem is that complexes don't differentiate very well. They're knee-jerk reflex responses. And the other problem is that virtually every disordered environment is a magnification of something that is also present in normal environments. So if you've got a complex that's regulating your behavior and you go out into the world, it will find exactly what it's looking for because it's there. It's there. All relationships are, to some degree, abusive. So if the complex is sensitive to a certain kind of abuse, it's going to find it. But unfortunately, because it's the primary mechanism by which such experiences are metabolized, it will metabolize only that to which it is sensitive. So if the abusive element in the relationship is 1% of the total relational capacity, the complex will deliver it to the individual as 100%. And there's a distortion, not in kind, but in degree. You know, Harry Stack Sullivan said, psychosis is a matter of degree, not kind. Well, that's true for everything. Yeah. Oh, okay. So those are the two ways. Those are the two reasons. Either consciousness hasn't had the opportunity to develop itself, or in order for the organism to survive, consciousness has had to be subservient to the complexes, because they could deal much better with what the environment was all about. Yeah.
Would you give us a working definition of complexes? You know, as you're continuing to use that, just so kind of.
Yeah. A complex, as far as Jung was concerned, is a nuclear element which consists of an archetypal valencing surrounded by associations, which are the stuff of experience which has been assimilated by the archetype according to a feeling tone. All archetypes create feeling tones. And Jung was very curious early on when he talked about feeling tones, because the first word he used for feeling tones was value. See? And values and feeling tones are definitely related. You know, feeling types, when we talk about feeling types, well, I'm a feeling type. We're not talking about people who have feelings. Everybody has feelings. Everybody experiences feelings. Feeling types, according to Jung, would be more accurately called evaluating types. So that, well, we'll go into type and function real quickly here. We have extroverted attitude and introverted attitude. The extroverted attitude is more connected to the environment and what's going on in the environment. The introverted attitude is more connected with what's going on inside, the internal environment. The data that comes to us comes through one of two ways, sensing or intuiting. Sensing is very concrete, very detail-oriented, very tactile, very substantive. This chair has, you know, a couple of legs and blah, blah, blah. You know, it puts things together from its component parts, so to speak. It starts with the parts and comes up with the whole. Intuition is just the opposite. It starts with the whole and then goes into the parts. Intuition is a kind of felt sense of what's there. The classic old example of the two docs who walk into a room, and one doctor says to the other about the patient, well, it's clear that she's got chicken pox. And the other doctor says, well, let's wait till the tests come back. You know, the first is intuitive, takes one look, has a sense immediately. The other really wants to know, you know, and wants to know just what the various gradations are. So those are the ways in which data comes to us through our sensing or our intuiting. And we tend to organize our apprehension of the environment in different ways according to those two. How we organize the data that comes to us is either through thinking or feeling. Thinking is just what we think it is. It's cognitive, it's rational, it's comparing, contrasting, defining, sorting out in terms of characteristics. Or we do it through feeling, and feeling is evaluating, and this is a kind of which is more or less valuable. How we would place it on a hierarchy of values. This is better than that, this is not as good as this. This really is more appropriate than that. It's a kind of judging, if you will. And so those are the six of them. We've got extroverted, introverted, sensing, intuiting, and thinking and feeling. Now, just to put in a plug here, there are a couple of personality type tests out there which will tell you what you are. And the first one that really was formulated was called the Gray Wheelwright. It isn't used much anymore. It's a forced choice test. You're either or. The other is the Myers-Briggs, which is another forced choice, which is you're either or. Both of those mechanisms and all forced choice mechanisms are flawed. They don't come near to telling you what you really are. In fact, what they tell you more about yourself is what type and function you tend to utilize when you're forced to choose something. You know? That's why so many people come out feeling types. You know, well, I force choose, I'm going to do that kind of a thing. The best one is the Singer-Loomis Inventory of Personality, which has a Likert scale. Most often to less often. So that you can place yourself on a scale. You don't have to choose one or the other. You're more inclined or less inclined, or always, never, usually, sometimes, or in the middle. And what the Singer-Loomis does is it says that none of these things exist on their own. None of these exist without being connected to something else. So you basically have, and I'm not doing my math here, but I think an eightfold scale. Maybe it's sixfold. Introverted feeling, introverted sensing, introverted intuiting, introverted thinking, extroverted going through those. Yeah, so it is. It's an eight scale. So you're not just intuitive, you're extroverted intuiting or you're introverted intuiting. And what it boils down to is that we all are somewhere on the scale there. It just simply is not true that to the degree that you are sensate, you are not intuitive. To the degree you are feeling, you're not thinking. That's bizarre. That's ridiculous. It doesn't make sense at all. So what you do is you find out in most situations, and also in those situations where you happen to be filling out a personality profile, where's your intuition? How high are you relying on your extroverted intuition as opposed to your introverted intuition? Where's your extroverted sensate in relation to all of this? And you can come out very high on extroverted sensate and extroverted intuition, okay? Because that's the nature of the beast. You can be both. Digression into types. So the complex then basically is a network of associations surrounding an archetypal core organized by a feeling tone. Or, as Jung says, volume 8, paragraph 201, a complex is the image of a certain psychic situation which is strongly accentuated emotionally and is, moreover, incompatible with the habitual attitude of consciousness. This image has a powerful inner coherence. It has its own wholeness and, in addition, a relatively high degree of autonomy, so that it is subject to the control of the conscious mind only to a limited extent. And therefore, this is the most important thing, behaves like an animated foreign body in the sphere of consciousness. Well, it's not so much that they have you, but they share the psyche with you. You're sharing the psyche with a bunch of other people just like you type thing, you know. So that... You know, I remember when I was in Zurich at one point, I thought I was going crazy. When I was living in Zurich, I was in a situation where I was living with my wife and my one-year-old. Of course, living with a one-year-old would make anybody go crazy. You know, I mean, it's just... And the Institute would be out of session for long periods of time, a couple of months, you know, at which point my analyst would usually go on one of his great travels, and I would be alone with no job, no place to go, no money. You know, Switzerland was just ridiculously expensive. No school, nothing to do, and periodically my wife and child would go off to Amsterdam to visit my wife's sister, and I'd be kind of left there all alone. And I was, all my life, what would most charitably be described as an agitated depressive. Depression was not allowed in my family. Depression was a sign of moral inferiority. I remember when I saw Rebel Without a Cause, and I was just taken by James Dean and his brooding moodiness, and I remember one day I was doing my best James Dean in the living room, and my mother walked in and said, "What's the matter with you?" And I said, "Oh, I don't know. And she goes, "Well, go do something." You know, that was the attitude towards reflection in our family, you know. So I hit Zurich, and I hit my first depression, you know, and it was really big. I mean, I didn't think I was going to come out of it. I thought, this is great. You know, I have not finished my doctorate. I don't have a job. I'm 30 years old. I've moved my family to this country where we're living like paupers, and I have no future. It's all gone. And I began to just sort of go crazy, and these rhythms started going through my head, you know, and I really felt like I was, you know, losing everything. And suddenly this thought came to me, which seemed to define where I was, and the thought was, when you address me, who is the me you're addressing? I had no idea anymore the difference between ego and complexes. And I can laugh at it now, but man, I was terrified. I really thought that it was all over. I thought that I bought the farm, you know, that this was it. I'd never come back from this one. But I was really very much aware of the fact that there were a lot more people at home than I ever thought were there, and I didn't know who they were, and they were running the show. It was quite a discovery. It was very disturbing for a, you know, a very rational small town boy from upstate New York.
Could you repeat what you said about the complex behaves like a...
Yes, I love that phrase. And I'll give you another one that Jung says, that the The complex behaves like an animated foreign body in the sphere of consciousness. And Jung called the complexes the little people. They're the little people, which is classic Swiss, you know. It'd probably be the Volksli or something like that, you know, Li be for the line. And he described them, these are my own words, these are not Jung's, as part personalities that function within the psyche, with which the ego competes for control. But the complexes are very, very powerful. Yeah.
So I did tend to reflect on a couple that helped me. In the codependent literature, Murray Larson's, he wrote several books, and he had a way of describing people that were having trouble with their complexes and giving them some hope. You know, like you were expressing, this was really frustrating.
Yeah.
But he would advise them that they think of themselves as a bus, and that their bus was okay.
Right. Twisted. I'd expand that metaphor and say that for me, as the driver of the bus, I suddenly realized my steering wheel wasn't connected to anything, and that all the people on the bus had little steering wheels in their seats. It's a very disturbing phenomenon. And of course, when you see people who are actively hallucinating and addressing the sidewalk in very emotional terms, this is what they're addressing. So what we do is we take our complexes, because no one ever says to us as we're growing up, you know, there's more to you than meets the eye in terms of the number of people who are running the show there, you know. We have other ways of saying that, you know, control yourself, you know, I was beside myself with fear, what's gotten into you, you know, we do have ways of sort of suggesting this, but nobody ever says to us when we're around 20 years old, it's time you realize that there's more to you than you think, and there are all these aspects of you that are running the show, and because you have been taught that you are a unitary phenomenon and you're the one who's really in charge, what you're doing is you're seeing all of these things that are really you as being other people. You're projecting them out. And of course there are hooks. You know, there's a hook for every projection. If I think you're a real idiot, well, there's probably a way in which you are. There are none of us who are not. On the other hand, very few people have ever projected the role of the calm, quiet, benevolent, loving peacemaker on Adolf Hitler, and there are very few people who have projected the diabolical murderer of all humankind onto Gandhi. So you can have different size hooks, and it's up to you to decide how much is hook and how much is projection. You can project something onto somebody, and there can be a really massive hook there. If I project the homicidal maniac on the person who's holding a .44 to my head, there's a big hook. You know, that person really is a homicidal maniac, and my projection is not necessarily just an aspect of me that's projected onto that person. But if I want to deal with that person, probably the best thing I could do is get into more contact with the homicidal maniac inside myself. When I work with torture survivors and try to bring them back from the experiences they've had, what's most useful to me is my highly sadistic side. My highly sadistic side that loves to see other people in pain. Not a nice part of you to get in touch with, but that's the part of me that helps me to understand what the torturer was trying to do. And when you understand that, then you can begin to undo what the torturer was doing. In effect, I go into competition with the torturer, and it's a point of pride to be able to out-sadistic the torturer, take the person away from the torturer, that sort of a thing. So to the degree that we understand our complexes and can communicate with them, we can communicate with people who are also possessed by the same complexes. Anger is a very good example of that. Anger is something that we're all taught to suppress, and yet anger is a very useful thing to have, if only to find out when there's anger in the environment. We began to discover in Chicago in our analysts' meetings that the people who got angry were not always the people who were angry, you know? That there'd be people there who were just suppressing massive anger at one another, and some other poor, relatively sensitive person, usually an extroverted intuitive, would pick it up and start getting angry. And then we'd say, well, what are you angry about? And they really wouldn't know. So they'd make something up. You know, they'd think of what am I angry about? And it would be this ridiculous nothing. And then people would say, oh, this person's nuts. You know, meanwhile, there's this huge rage going on between two analysts who want to kill each other because they're operating on the same turf or something. So we began to get kind of a sense of that. And if you're in touch with your complexes, you can tell what's going on in the surround, and it's almost like radar in the fog. It'll give you a sense of where the reefs are, you know, of where the shoreline is, and you can navigate your way through it. Because a lot of the feelings you'll be having through your complexes are because your complexes are resonating sympathetically with something that's going on in the environment. And it's not yours at all. So this is what we basically mean by getting to understand the complexes. We get to understand that there are aspects of our personality that are functioning that don't necessarily have anything to do with the ego. Are we relatively clear on this, or am I laboring the point? Yeah.
The part of that, you just used anger as if it was a complex? No.
Anger is a feeling tone into which a whole bunch of associations will be. Right, right. But if somebody else is feeling angry, most of us will pick it up, you know. But we're not really taught that, you know. We're really not taught that if there's an absence of an objective, verifiable, specifiable example of anger, that anger could still be present or not. And yet when we're kids, that's all we pick up. You know, we pick it up all the time. Kids live in an environment that's constantly, you know, deluging them with information that is not verifiable, either by the adults around, because they're suppressing it, or by the child, because the child can't verify anyway. There's no ego. You know, there's no consciousness there to do it. So they kind of resonate with things like that.
Does the anger have to be connected with the complex?
Yes, yes. Anger is always connected with a complex. Right. It's a feeling tone. Anger is a feeling tone. And it's always connected with a complex. We all have our areas that make us angry. We all have our sensitivity to things that then create anger. And they can be completely different from the person next to us. Right? So that the two of us can be in a situation, and I'll be enraged, and you'll be wondering, what is what? What's the problem? You know.
So that would be true of all feelings then?
They're all connected with complexes. All feelings are connected with experiences. All experiences are associations that cluster around the archetype through the feeling tone.
Unless they're biochemically produced.
Interesting point. Interesting point. We're looking at that. You know, we'll see. We'll see. Yeah, that's very interesting. Back in the days when a number of us were doing a lot of LSD, the question was, is it the drug or is it what's there? You know?
Is it creating something?
Sure.
Allowing the experience?
Sure. And I remember I used to have this one particular visual impression whenever I took LSD. Every time, same thing. And it was indescribable. I could not describe it to people. It just did not fit categories that there was no language to express what I was seeing. You know, there was no word for what I was seeing. And I used to think, well, it's got to just be the acid. You know? And then about eight years ago, on the cover of Science News was the exact thing that I had been seeing every time I did acid. And it was a fractal attractor. And as I read the characteristics of fractal attractors, which is that you can't reduce any of the functions to a line, everything folds into everything else, that was exactly the characteristic of what I was seeing. And so that was, you know, who knows? Pardon me?
Would it become complex if it didn't start off?
If it's not emotionally charged, no.
But if it was?
If it was, it will become a complex. If it's not emotionally charged, but it's in any way metabolized cognitively, it'll become part of consciousness.
Metabolized meaning energy given to it?
Metabolized means chewed through, digested, its salient points gotten in touch with, whatever it has available for your use, available, that sort of thing. Yeah?
So, click. So, the Eastern traditions which teach you to tone down these valuations, so everything is the same as possible, attachment to this, that are really getting you into consciousness by removing some of these feeling values.
Right.
Which then
right. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
So when someone like Sardello or Hillman invites us to take the perspective of the world or of the things themselves, in a sense, they're inviting us to try to set aside our complexes and our kind of feeling resonances that are self-oriented and kind of see the world from a more, you might say, objective standpoint, not so subjectively. Related.
I would think so, yeah, right.
How do we do that if the ego is complex?
Pardon me?
How do we do that if the ego is a complex?
Because the ego is the only complex whose organization is not feeling tone. It's rationality.
So the ego would be used to do what we're talking about?
Yeah.
What's your thought or feeling about that sort of approach to the value of that, or the feasibility of being able to take that kind of approach to the world? The soul of the world to present itself as kind of.
Yeah. I think it's really good. Yeah. I think that's exactly what needs to be done. We're going to get to that. We're going to move through individuation here in terms of its stages. Yeah.
I was curious to know, among the limitless archetypes in the collective unconscious.
Right.
What besides individual experience in the world determines which archetypes are going to wind up being at the core of our complexes? Is there
nothing. That's it. Individual experience determines which archetypes are going to be at the core of our. There is some thought that we are born with inherent predispositions to become certain things and certain ways. And then there's the thought that whatever archetypes are connected with those potentials will be the ones that become active, will become more active. That's an awfully tough one to really substantiate. We can substantiate the other hypothesis pretty well, that our complexes will be comprised of the archetypes plus whatever experiences we have found ourselves in. And to some degree, we can account for the differences in people who experience the same things through something like sensitive dependence on initial conditions, which is a kind of chaos idea, that because the psyche is a phenomenon that feeds back on itself and iterates and compounds so rapidly that even the most minute difference in starting place produces vast differences in very short times. But there's very much the idea with regard to racial heritage, family, genetics, if you will, in Jungian thought, the idea that we come into life with archetypes that are kind of primed to really take over, to really direct us in certain ways, that it's hard to discount that. I think that's really, really quite true.
There's a lot of folk wisdom and code-setting of the whole.
Yeah.
Well,
as my wife and I say, the snot doesn't fall far from the nose. You know what I mean? Yeah, right, yeah.
So it's almost like an invocation of like a spirit or a demon in images of magic, where experience lived by a person sort of draws the archetype toward it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And there's a sense in which we might actually find ourselves seeking out experiences that are in conjunction with a particular archetypal potential waiting to be fulfilled.
But then the notion of something like a daimon being a sense of an organizing principle for our life, that's almost the other side of it, that like a person is born with this genie or this daimon that then organizes experiences.
Yeah.
So it's like the two are both two approaches to how archetypes come to influence our lives.
That's right. To me, it's never been very beneficial to really be concerned with the whole nature-nurture question, the whole issue of whether we're born with archetypes, the daimon, if you will, that's waiting to kind of direct us in certain ways, or whether it just happens as a result of our life experience in conjunction with archetypal potentials that are exactly the same for all human beings. I don't know.
Did you say yesterday, like, breastfeeding, this sucking impulse as an archetype?
That's instinctual, yes.
We're born with.
Right.
Could you differentiate between those kind of things we're born with and other archetypes? You know, I mean, I guess where my confusion is.
No, I can't do that. I don't know how.
We have this impulse to eat because we're hungry.
Right.
And then we associate putting things in our mouth as something that we is good.
Right.
What are the other questions? Are we born with a group of those kind of things? In other words, we develop through experience, or is it all just like a hand we're dealt?
I don't know. I just, it's way beyond me. Yeah.
Can
I'm sorry.
Aren't there certain basic instincts, though, that it would be pretty easy to prove we all have?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Such as the need to eat, the
right.
need to procreate, the need to be a part of something.
Right. Archetypes are more difficult.
That's
sort of like, you know, they're almost limitless. I guess it gets down to, are we born with psychological mechanisms that are virtually identical?
Right.
I tend to think we are. I really do. I think the human organism is absolutely uniform right throughout the genre. And it's all a matter of what kinds of conditions you're born into, what actually ends up happening. But who knows? You know, it's not something we can dissect very readily. You know, it might be fun, for example, to do MRIs on every infant born immediately after birth, you know, and get a sense of, you know, somehow get a sense of what the landscape looks like. But so much of the brain is unformed at birth and gets formed during experience. And if the experience isn't there, that part of the brain doesn't form, as I was saying earlier. So it's like...
The potentials are there, but the experience then develops.
Right. See, I'm an analyst. My main interest is how do you help people through what they're in, you know. And some of this helps a little bit to give me some orienting devices, but in terms of being an empirical researcher type, it's not something I've really done enough work in to be able to really give you a good answer. Yeah, you've had your hand up for a while there. You've been very patient. I see, right. Yeah, well, yeah, right. Oh, absolutely.
Right,
sure.
Unconscious, and, you know,
sure.
As this organism encounters.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.